Thank you, everyone, for coming to this panel on science, medicine, and natural history, queering scientific arms. So we're going to have this session like a sort of regular panel. We're going to have three speakers speaking for about 15 to 20 minutes, and they'll speak one after another, and then we'll have about half an hour, hopefully, for questions and discussion. I'm Jen Grove. I'm a researcher at the University of Exeter in the UK. I just have a few announcements before we start from the programme. Straight after this session at 11:30, we've got lunch, and we also have film matinee, San Diego's gay bar history, and an audio piece, Lavender Songs. And then we have another film matinee in your break at 2:30, which is San Paolo in Hi-Fi. At 5:30, pardon me, we have the dinner break, and we're also going to have a group photo. So it's in your packs, but the location is the big steps looking over the pond out the front. And then after that, we have our closing evening podium with a range of speakers to close this fantastic conference. So that's all the announcements for now. And I'll first introduce our first speaker. She probably doesn't need very much introduction. I'm sure all know her by now, Kate Davison. And Kate is a PhD student at the University of Melbourne in Australia, writing a transnational history of homosexual aversion therapy during the Cold War. And Kate's presentation today is going to be on Power Flip, examining the psychiatric establishment via the personal archive of a bisexual homosexual aversion therapist. Thank you, Kate.
Okay, so actually I've got a different title up here because when I went to do the PowerPoints, you know, you sort of recycle these things. I'm going to admit that I have given a version of this presentation once before. And I noticed the title, the previous title that I'd used was this, Intimate Archives and the Ethics of Sexology History, which I actually think probably maybe is a bit more what I'm trying to kind of address today. So the main question is that I want to end with is this a queer archive? So maybe keep that question in mind as I speak. So as Jen mentioned, the title of my PhD is Sex Psychiatry in the Cold War, a Transnational History of Homosexual Aversion Therapy from 1948 to 1981. Before I get into the topic of my paper today, I'll contextualise it briefly with the overall project. But just a piece of advice. I have a couple of quotes today that might be distressing, so just so that people are aware. So the star of the show is the Australian psychiatrist Neil McConaghy, who was born in 1927 and died in 2005. Between 1962 and 1974, McConaghy built an internationally recognised career as the leading Australian practitioner of homosexual aversion therapy. And these years were really the heyday of behaviour therapy in Britain, promoted especially at the Maudsley Hospital in London under Hans-Jörg Eysenck. McConaghy was not the only practitioner of homosexual aversion therapy in Australia, but he had by far the most significant public and professional reputation for it. From 1964 to his retirement in 1997, he was based at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of New South Wales, and he worked clinically down the road at the Prince Henry Hospital in Little Bay. And this is McConaghy. So that's him at the Maudsley Hospital, and these are some holiday pics. This is McConaghy on Australian television in 1966, and I believe I have a video file here, but I'm not sure if... No, it's not going to play. Actually, I don't really have time for the video, but I can show you later if people are interested. He specialised in all areas of sexuality and gender orientation treatment, and after homosexuality was removed from the list of mental illnesses in the mid-1970s, his primary clinical focus shifted to abusive sexuality, that is, paedophilia and child abuse. McConachie was a Marxist. He was heavily influenced by the Russian physician Ivan Pavlov, whose psychophysiological approach to psychological medicine had been official doctrine in the Eastern Bloc since 1949. And this framework developed in contradistinction and often with outright disdain for the psychoanalytic framework based upon Freudian ideas of psychosexual arrest in early childhood. Therapeutic methods in this therapeutic methods in the psychoanalytic framework were referred to as talking cures. So the psychophysiological therapeutic framework based upon Pavlov's idea of conditionability focused instead upon treating behavioural symptoms. In McConachie's view, Pavlov's methods had been misunderstood by his British colleagues, and many of their experiments failed to meet rigorous scientific standards, in his view, at the expense of their patients. Instead, he took his inspiration directly from a team of Czechoslovakian psychiatrists and psychologists led by Dr. Kurt Freund, and based jointly at the Institute for Sexology and the Department of Psychiatry, part of the medical faculty of the Charles University in Prague. This is the Psychiatric Institute, and this is the front door of the Sexological Institute, which is still there today and still operates as an advice clinic. Freund's team in Prague had conducted a pioneering experiment in homosexual aversion therapy involving 222 patients between 1950 and 1962. So I should note that these 222 patients, these were part of the research project into homosexuality in general, but only 67 of those 222 were actually treated with aversion therapy. So aversion therapy was just one component of a broader research project. The findings led them to agitate successfully for homosexual law reform in Czechoslovakia, and decriminalisation was achieved in 1961. Following the Prague Spring in 1968, Freund left Czechoslovakia and emigrated to Canada. It's unclear when they first had contact, but McConachie and Freund were in touch, and they met in person at the latest at an international sexology congress in Haifa in 1981. And they maintained a lifelong professional relationship. So these are some examples of letters, handwritten letters in McConachie's archive, which I'm going to get to. So what is homosexual aversion therapy? The lifespan of post-war homosexual aversion therapy, which shouldn't be confused with gay conversion therapy that we know today, was limited to the years between 1951 and around 1974, 1976, 1977, there's some evidence that it was still being used in 1979 by some of these people. Thank you. And 13 left.
No, you have 13. Oh, so you've got 13 left.
Oh, sorry.
Carry on.
Okay. Because I've got 13 on here left. No. Okay. Is that wrong? Oh, sorry. I'll get to it. So I'm going to skip that bit about aversion therapy. So this is McConachie's mind map of where his aversion therapy fits into the Pavlovian sort of paradigm. I'm happy to explain that later. So the New McConachie Archive. The material that forms the basis of the second half of my thesis is the McConachie Archive in these boxes. So I first heard of Neil McConachie in 2015 while I was in the early phase of searching for source material. And after learning a bit about him, in particular his clashes and interactions with early gay liberation activists, I came across a webpage with the summary of his last book, which he had tried unsuccessfully to have published the year before he died. The webpage was last updated in 2006, but there was an email address for one of his daughters, and I sent off an email asking whether there might be any information on him available, not expecting anything back. I certainly did not expect a reply, but a month or so later, one of his daughters wrote to me and said, "Oh, yeah, you know, I've got these 16 boxes in my shed. Come and have a look." She lived in the Blue Mountains in Sydney, and so I went up and stayed with her for a week and had a look through the book. Through the boxes, and she has now lent them to me. She's given them to me on permanent loan. So I sorted through some of the material and I was left with 9 at the end. So these 9 boxes contain some of these things. They contain film reels used in aversion therapy. This is an electrode machine. He was a bit of a... does anyone know the 80s show MacGyver? You know, where you like put things together with like sticky tape and things. So he created this system, and these are some of the film reels that he has. He also has all the log books from the studies of aversion therapy, tapes that he made, slides, his drafts of his paper that he gave to the American Psychiatric Association conference in San Francisco, and here are some records of the penile plethysmograph. So, and also some images from his research. So I'm just going to play this. Hopefully this will play. No, we're not getting the audio. Doesn't matter.
Much more delicate and easily damaged by the subject and needed supervision when it was being put on. Additionally, in our pilot studies, the penile changes, as recorded by the plethysmograph, seem to be a more accurate index of the patient's reported subjective sexual orientation than were the penile changes recorded by the strain gauge. So for all of these reasons, it was decided to continue to measure volume change with the plethysmograph, as Freund had done.
So that sound that you heard was me kind of pressing record on the tape recorder. I'm going to slow down a little because there was a bit of a misunderstanding with how much time I had taken, so I'm going to slow down a bit. It doesn't matter. Okay, so I got a bit of a shock. So going back to these tapes that you see in the picture, that was a recording from one of these tapes which are in these boxes. So we have... It's such a rich archive of material about his clinical treatment, his clinical projects, and his experimentation. But I want to explain the plethysmograph to you because that was a lecture series that he created for a tape an audio library that was run out of the United States. They commissioned him to create 3 lectures about his work in 1973. I'm just going to go back to my paper. Sorry about this. So these are these are the drafts of the paper that he delivered in the United States, where American gay liberation activists for the first time interrupted a major psychiatric gathering. It was one of their earliest ZAP actions, so to say, and it was his speech that they interrupted. And he has there's a whole lot of newspaper reports that came out about this, and he has reflections, and he described it to people in his correspondence, this moment that activists stormed in. And there's quite a difference of interpretation about how it happened. You know, the salacious reporters obviously wanted to play up this kind of thing as a confrontation. There were rumours about tomatoes being thrown and things like that, but actually he has a very different interpretation of what happened, and he says that he negotiated with these activists and said that, I just want to finish giving my paper, and they allowed him to do so, according to him. But anyway, it's a different interpretation. But the major innovation of the Prague research had been the penile plethysmograph, and this was what was most attractive to Neil McConachy. So after testing penile plethysmography himself, McConachy began the first of 5 studies, or subject cohorts, testing aversion therapy. He found that he needed to redesign the plethysmograph, as Freund's model was cumbersome. So that's that slide there. This is Freund's model, and this is McConachy's version. And the Lagactyl bottle is kind of a funny story, because Lagactyl is actually an antipsychotic drug. It has nothing to do with anything. It's just the canister that he had lying around on his... as I said, he was a MacGyver. So he MacGyvered a penile plethysmograph together because he wanted any practitioner to be able to make one out of anything that they had lying around. So the top is just the end of a finger stall latex cut off and shoved over the end. So this measures volume change on the penis.
We had designed was very robust and capable of being put on by the patient.
In 1964, he moved to Sydney from Melbourne and began an experiment heavily inspired by Freund. By this stage, electrical aversion therapy had been developed, so he designed his study as a comparison of apomorphine, nausea-inducing drug, versus electrical aversion therapy. In connection with his worldview and political stance, McConachy repeatedly argued that treating patients with aversion therapy was at their request was consistent with a liberal humanist position. He argued that the role of the therapist was to reduce suffering. If that suffering was caused by unwanted sexual desire, then the therapist should work with the patient to reduce or eliminate those desires. Thank you. So this is a letter sent to him by gay liberation activists in Sydney. And this is also a rather more nasty letter sent to him in invisible ink, by the way. So I'm holding this up to the light. And it says, McConachy, it's time that vermin like you were exterminated. You who, under the mantle of scientific humanism, prey upon those who have chosen to derive as ill, you are a vile monster. The only good aversion therapist is a dead one. Won't you sing along? And this was sent to him by the brigade, as they called themselves. Again and again in his various justifications, McConachy's peculiar interpretation of Marxist scientific values clashed with anti-oppression movements from below. My intention in detailing the history of homosexual aversion therapy from the practitioner's point of view is not to privilege what in Foucauldian terms might be called the voices of power. I dedicate chapters in my thesis to the voices of patients and activists as well. But my goal is really to investigate the theoretical, methodological, and clinical underpinnings of this area of medical history as it was presented and debated by practitioners and their peers in order to fully understand how it was justified and on what theoretical, ethical, and moral, political, technical, medical, or scientific grounds. So moving to the further on in the archive, some of the key ethical issues obviously I'm faced with relate to what to do with the archive after I finish my thesis, but more importantly, the patient records. These include information that most people would deem highly sensitive. But working with this archive and noticing the extent to which these two sides of the scenario intersect, clash, butt up against one another, contradict one another, or even overlap and agree has been a palpable experience for me so far. Here are some more of the logbook. So this is these are patient names on the left that I've obscured. And as you can see, it sort of has their homosexual desire before treatment, after treatment. There are also other lists where their Kinsey score is listed and their penile plethysmograph results. As historians, not only of queer and LGBTQ lives, but also of any subaltern or oppressed group, is well aware, we are used to a situation in which documentation of our own or our subjects' history has not been of their own creation, but has been through the prism of law enforcement, medicine, the political system, judicial processes. In other words, all the elements of the architecture of repression identified by Foucault and others. Consider, for example, this recollection from Fabian Loschiavo, whom I've interviewed on behalf of the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. And by the way, this is Loschiavo's first appointment in McConachy's diaries, appointment books. In a darkened room, I had to drop my trousers to my ankles and put this metal cup thing on and then put the rubber over the penis. Then there was a slide projector and either McConachy or his assistant was behind me, and then the slide would come up and sometimes there'd be a shock, sometimes there wouldn't. And I had to tell him on a range of 0 to 10, was it this painful or that painful? I remember a group of students coming in. I must have been very upset because they were standing and taking notes and one of them detached himself and he said, "Are you okay?" And just those words of compassion made me cry. It wasn't like it was massively painful. It was just the whole thing was so desperately, awfully sad, and I thought that this is what I have to do. I'll go through this and I'll be okay. With the McConachy archive, I have in some cases been able to match up the narratives of former patients with records in the archive, as in the case with McConachy's appointment diaries. And there are other records. So going back to these books and these books, and I've been able to match them up to some contemporary reports published in the gay press of having had this treatment. So I'm on my last piece of paper. So Fabian actually has been pleased to learn of the archive. He was actually very, very glad to know that someone had discovered it and that it existed and that there were all these records, because in some ways he said that he found it affirming that there are these records of what he experienced, and I think that that's been something common across many former patients. But the archive I have at my disposal is that of a psychiatrist and sexologist, the taxonomer, the one in control of definitions of others, the chief investigator, the scrutinizer, the representative of power and the medical establishment, the enemy, as the organizers of the intervention at the APA conference in San Francisco put it. But what happens if we flip the spotlight? So what about, for example, when the historian finds things like this in the archive of this psychiatrist? This is the letter. I worry about your homosexuality and how it affects me, and about my promiscuity and how it affects you. So this is a letter from Neil McConachie's wife, Helen, wife-to-be. They met in London while he was at the Maudsley Institute. They eventually got married the following year. She moved to Australia, and they made a life together in Australia. And it was a genuine marriage. It wasn't fake. She wasn't a beard, as they call them these days. That was a very, very genuine marriage, and they had two children, but he had sex with men throughout his life, and people have told me that the only female intimate partner that they remember him ever having was Helen. So, I mean, we find these things in the archive, and his final manuscript was called So You Say You're Straight. So he attempted, his final manuscript was never published, it was a book. So You Say You're Straight, and it was an attempt to try and sort of explain the forgotten category of heterosexual homosexuals, he called them. So these are people who are on the Kinsey scale. They're not in the middle. They're not bisexual. They're probably they're mostly heterosexual and they have some homosexual tendencies. Or they have a heterosexual marriage and they fuck guys. Or whatever, whatever kind of constellation that involves. So the question for the discussion is this archive queer? How do we queer this archive? Is this an archival collection that belongs in a queer archive? Or does it belong in the state library? Does it belong in the university archive of the university where he was a professor for most of his life? Is it a queer archive because it has these records of gay liberation? Is it something that we would want to have in our archives? Or is it compromised material? So I'm really interested to hear people's perspectives on that. And sorry for the interruption. So.
Thank you so much. Next up we have Virgil B.G. Taylor, and Virgil is an artist and an MA candidate in public histories at Birkbeck College in the UK, and Virgil will be giving a paper to us today, all okay?
There we go.
There we go, right. On zero patients, queer models for natural history. Thank you.
Hi everyone. So this presentation will take place kind of in three museums. The Museum of the City of New York, where I sometimes work, a semi-fictional natural history museum in Canada, and the all too real American Museum of Natural History, also in New York. And I'm gonna try to bring us kind of through these spaces. But I wanna start with some screwing. It is August 2018 in New York City. The weather is not dissimilar from the weather we've been having here this week, hot and humid. It is a crowded, uncomfortable room, a small security office in the foyer leading to the main hallway. There are about six of us shoved into this room. It's sweaty in there. I'm working hard, fucking around, trying to look methodical, and together as we try to get this big, tall thing through. Being an art handler is often a job that requires a performance of efficiency and professionalism, and consequentially a denial that you, like everybody else at the museum, have a body. It is not uncommon to be asked to act as an easel or a shelf for a painting or artifact. Just stand there and hold it. I worked with a heavy screwdriver to dig out screws lost in a well-worn wooden crate lid. I was being scrutinized by the artist, whose work was inside that crate, and the registrar from the museum. The latter felt little inhibition to express her horror that I was beginning to perspire as I struggled. So in this story, the artist is Jordan Eagles, and the artwork was his blood mirror, an ongoing sculptural project made of blood in acrylic resin. The sculpture is 213 centimeters tall, which is why it presented some difficulty when it was in the crate to get through a door, and hence me climbing on top of it in a little room trying to open the crate. So the sculpture is really made of blood, 59 blood samples in all, so it's kind of itself an archive. The blood, which is preserved permanently through its encapsulation in the resin, was deposited in two phases since 2015, and so Eagles these are Eagles' words. The first phase involved blood from an extraordinary group of 9 individuals, each with unique life experiences and perspectives, highlighting the hypocrisy and repercussions of the ban on blood donation by men who have sex with men in the U.S. and elsewhere, and the importance of full equality. The second phase combined blood from a community of 50-plus PrEP advocates, each of whom donated a single tube of blood, 50 tubes equals a full pint, the amount in a standard blood donation. So this sculpture is many things. It is a work of art, but it's important to Eagles that it is a political tool, that it is there to advocate around this policy concern about the blood ban. And significantly, it's also a little piece of nearly 60 people now presented in a museum. So I want us all to remember, as I go through this presentation, the bodies that find themselves in museums, and not just those who sweat and toil for some monetary compensation like mine, but more importantly to remember that in our museums, there are bodies of people who, because of racialized violence of dispossession and the abrogation of autonomy, which are part and parcel of colonialism, are robbed of themselves and are removed from their spiritual and cultural context for so-called scientific and anthropological study. So it's important to me to keep them in mind as we continue. So I was installing the blood mirror for the Museum of the City of New York's Wellcome Trust-funded exhibition, Germ City, Microbes in the Metropolis, which was on view from September 2018 until April of this year. And while the exhibition is rich with things that sparked a lot of questions for me, it was the inclusion of the blood mirror that particularly spurred this conversation. And it began with a conversation with my colleague Kyle Croft, who I proposed this with, who couldn't be here with us, but he's in New York and is very much here in spirit, so shout out to Kyle. So Germ City is part of the Wellcome Trust's ongoing grant giving project, the Contagious Cities, which is funded by the Wellcome Trust, which is the kind of nonprofit charity research kind of continuation of Burroughs Wellcome, which was and is a pharmaceutical company that is notable for our context for having produced and sold AZT, which was an early and ineffective AIDS treatment. As part of this project, the Museum of the City of New York presented Germ City, which was, in their words, an attempt to visualize the surprising interplay between people and pathogens in an urban context through historical artifacts, contemporary art, maps, and digital interactives. MCNY presented Germ City in partnership with their neighboring institution, the New York Academy of Medicine, and within the larger Contagious Cities umbrella, there was an exhibition called Contagious Cities in Hong Kong at the Tai Kwan Center for Heritage and Arts, and actually right now in Berlin at the Museum for Naturkunde, there's a project called Coexistence, which is also a Contagious Cities project. Like many of Wellcome's public projects, Germ Cities represents an exhibition-making practice which extends connections between art history and natural history. But as the show was explained to me and I encountered more of the artifacts during the installation and saw the images included alongside those included alongside artworks like Eagles, the premise of the exhibition, exploring the history of contagion, seemed oddly familiar to me. So now I'm going to show you a clip from John Grayson's 1993 Zero Patients, the eponymous film of this presentation, which is, I will say now, is a masterwork of queer cinema, which some of you may be familiar with, but I'll kind of catch you up on me after this clip.
Yeah? Ah, Dick, come right in.
I think I found it.
Found what?
A new centerpiece for our whole of contagion. Something groundbreaking, yet crowd-pleasing. display about patient zero.
Who? I don't follow.
Well, right now, our Hall of Contagion has a display for every major epidemic in human history. Cholera, typhus, bubonic plague, influenza, syphilis, diphtheria. What's missing? AIDS, of course.
We've covered AIDS. The African green monkey.
That green monkey was simply the way the AIDS virus crossed over from animals to Africans. Patient zero is the primum mobile, the first person to bring AIDS to North America. Allow me, sir.
Lotet anguis inerba, a snake, lurks in the grass. This chart is from a scientific study conducted in 1982. The doctors interviewed as many...
This is all very well, Dick, but what exactly are you proposing?
The latest in high-tech image bombardment. The music video approach. The youth of today demands something as urgent and modern as AIDS itself.
Sounds expensive.
Patient Zero is a flight attendant. Perhaps the airlines would sponsor it. Well, perhaps not. Here's another possibility. These are pharmaceutical manufacturers who make treatment drugs for AIDS victims. Now, surely one of these companies would leap at the chance of funding our display.
Possibly. There's the issue of local relevance, of course.
That's the beauty of it. Patient Zero was Canadian.
A promiscuous, irresponsible, homosexual Canadian. Hardly a positive role model, Dick.
He was French-Canadian.
Ah. French-Canadian.
My passion for discovery has led me near and far. Rebecca, Medina, Brazil, and Zanzibar. I speak 40 languages. I've written 50 books. My friends include witch doctors, scientists, and crooks. My translations of sex classics are thought the very best. Both my sutra and my nights pass the titillation test. I detail the mating habits of a dozen different tribes. And shocked old stuffy England with my studies of hot ties. Victorians were Cartesian. They revered the intellectual. They wished to know the world, but recoiled from that of sexual. Point of all the facts when you censor out the crew. My scientific searchings were dismissed as low and new.
Let's all be empiricists, victors of the brain. Through our wit and brilliance, we can know the world again. We'll classify and label and find out. A culture of certainty will vanish every doubt. A culture of certainty will vanish every doubt.
I don't think.
Geography has mapped every river, every glade, yet we still have much to learn about the mystery of AIDS. Let's explore this foreign body, learn the customs of its cells, classify its nooks and crannies, pull its chains and ring its bells. We will never find a cure till we isolate the source. Once we know where it came from, we can kill it off by force. What's the origin of this virus? Europe, Zaire, Haiti?
The clues are here before us, patient zero holds the key. Let's all be empiricists. Victors of the mind, rulers of the stupid, leaders of the blind, an empire of knowledge will conquer all the rot. A culture of certainty will put us back on top. A culture of certainty will put us back on top.
I'll have to talk to the board about this.
Magnificent. I'll start right away.
Yeah? Odd. So, for some context, this FIP from zero patients So's Dick, or Sir Richard Francis Burton, who, having gained immortality by at some point locating the Fountain of Youth in his explorations of the world, is at work as a taxidermist at the Natural History Museum in Toronto on, as you heard, a new Hall of Contagion, which will now feature Patient Zero at the heart of his exhibition so he can achieve the fame and notoriety he earned for translating 1001 Arabian Nights 110 years prior. So Zero Patients is like a million things, and there were about 100 different versions of what clip I could have shown you from this film, but you should know that it is a ghost story, it is a Busby Berkeley synchronized swimming musical, it is a love story, and it's a fantasy, but really at its heart it's a film about AIDS activism. So some of the best scenes in the film depict collectively organized, politically radical AIDS activists working to publicly protest Burton's Hall of Contagion. But to kind of get back to the Museum of the City of New York, I wanted to briefly return to this slide from Burton's presentation, where we see the pharmaceutical companies that in 1992, in this fictional film, are profiting off of AIDS healthcare, and points out this, our friend here at Burroughs Belch, which we might be reminded of Burroughs Welcome. And so kind of just imagine the possible sponsorship of the Hall of Contagion by Burroughs Belchum and the very real sponsorship of Germ City by Burroughs Welcome is where I kind of want to take this conversation. The context of this fictional exhibition in the film suggests a framework for critiquing Welcome's very real exhibition practices. If we take seriously Germ City's eclectic exhibition of art and artifacts, then it's not difficult to view the Museum of the City of New York, which is a history museum's exhibition, is clearly a natural history exhibition. This, of course, has been made extra clear by the inclusion of a project at Berlin's Natural History Museum in the same grant scheme. There is a long and vital history of the critique of natural history museums by those subjected to its collecting practices. In recent years, attention has only grown, whether it's the calls last year to return much of what is held in French museums to their originating contexts in former colonies in Africa, or the very complicated rollout in the U.S. of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA. Cool. Now that kind of brings us to the third museum, the American Museum of Natural History, which in the last few years has seen major protests organized by a group called Decolonize This Place, which has anti-Columbus Day tours of the museum to highlight the museum's problematic collections and exhibition practices and to demand the removal of an equestrian statue of Theodore Roosevelt from the museum's steps. Like in the movie, the activists involved in Decolonize This Place bring the dioramas to life, retelling the stories misrepresented in the halls of the AMNH from the perspective of the dispossessed. As in Zero Patients, these activists are not just concerned with the misrepresentation on its own, but connect these inside the museum work with broader questions of decolonization. So in Zero Patients, you'll see in the final clip I'll show, there's a kind of connecting this problem of the specific exhibition to these bigger questions around HIV and AIDS and healthcare. In both museums, the protests are loud, ecstatic, musical, and seriously challenge the space of the museum. So right now, Decolonize This Place has been doing a lot of work at the Whitney Museum in New York, calling out the Whitney for receiving financial support from their board member, Warren B. Canders, who is a tear gas manufacturer. And so if you search Decolonize This Place, they're still doing plenty of things and plenty of actions, and they're really an amazing group in New York City. So the point I want to get home in this presentation is that, to return to the original story, is that as we finally put the blood mirror into that position in the gallery, Jordan, Eagles, and I acknowledge that as the two gay men in the room, that I probably knew some of the men whose blood made up the artwork, and I laughed and suggested that I had probably fucked one or two of them, a potential consanguinity. This is not to equate the blood mirror with the human remains kept by museums of natural history, or to kind of oversimplify the difference in the relationships of how those blood samples are in the museum versus how bodies and cultural objects find themselves in natural history museums, but more as a kind of key opportunity to use the Zero Patients and the kind of activism it represents to think critically about the exhibitions that we can go to today. As HIV/AIDS becomes ever more historicized, In face of plain facts and reality of an ongoing crisis that no longer features gay white men at its center, we would do well, as the AIDS activists and Zero Patients do, to not be afraid to intervene. Critiques of natural history by indigenous people and actions that I've highlighted are above here are also responding to a mode of historicization that is a means to erase the lives still being led. While we are here at a conference with many museum workers, we should carefully consider our responsibility. So I'm going to end with a clip that I think restores some dignity and historical context to the exhibition in Zero Patients. And then I'll leave and we can move on to the next presentation.
Thank you so much for the presentation, Virgil, and the fantastic videos. And can you get through? Next up, we have Ellie Armstrong. Ellie is a PhD candidate at the University College London in the UK, and she's looking at how science is displayed in science museums. And Ellie will be speaking to us today on Queer in STEM, Scientific Identity, Queer Identity, and the Museum. Thanks, Ellie.
Thank you. I'm
Not entirely sure how I follow that video, but there we are. I'm strongly reminded of some friends I had at my undergrad who wrote a Theory of Justice, the musical, where Plato was Socrates was Plato's marionette puppet that sat on his lap. It was very funny. Anyway, would highly recommend. The videos are online. So I'm going to give somewhat of a Frankenstein talk. It's kind of two talks. Two streams of thought that I'm having at the moment that I was hoping by the time I arrived at this presentation would have merged into one in my life, but haven't. So perhaps there's an element that, like, maybe in the questions you might be able to help me see how these things can link together. So something that is close to my heart as somebody who was a scientist trained as an undergrad is that often when we talk about queerness and LGBTQ history, we talk about it in the context of historical or arts institutions. So up here on my slide, I have a number of tour interventions that have happened at museums, mostly in the UK, but in Europe more generally, that are highlighting queer history, that invite people to see it as part of the canon within those institutions. I'm actually involved in the LGBTQ tours at the University of Cambridge Museums and at the Victoria and Albert Museums now, where I try to bring some scientific and technical content to those spaces as well. So not only like querying the content, but querying the idea of what is arts or historical. But in general, this doesn't seem to be so much of a thing in science museums. So I, in 2018, so this time last year, ran a series of tours, which you can see down here at the bottom, were called Queering the Science Museum. And this was a tour series that lasted about an hour. We went around the museum of the Science Museum in London and looked at a number of different objects related to individuals who were STEM professionals, and who were also LGBTQ or queer. And we talked a lot about not only individuals, but also the way that science could be understood to be heteronormative in and of itself. So we spent some time talking about, for example, experiments that happen with vole rats, where there are two different types of vole rats. You can have prairie vole rats and meadow vole rats, and they have different sexual behaviors. One has the females have lots of different male partners and are very promiscuous, and one they are monogamous, they mate for life. And in a lot of the experiments that are done on understanding if there is a genetic component to promiscuity, instead of understanding whether we could take the vole rats who are promiscuous and insert genetic material into the monogamous ones, it's always the case that the monogamous genes are the ones that are trying to be exported or transplanted into the promiscuous vole rats. So we see in that like a heteronormative assumption about what is the best type of relationship that these animals could have. But we also talked about individuals in STEM. So for example, we talked about Alan Turing. So you can see the very far picture in the middle row on that side is in front of a picture of Alan Turing. Maybe does this have a laser? Does anyone know? Yay! Here you can see up at the back, just where my laser pointer is right now, is a photo of Alan Turing. And although the Science Museum in 2013 had a whole exhibition on Alan Turing, where they had in the final room information about his eventual his treatment with hormone replacement therapy in the 1950s and his eventual suicide as a result of this, there's nothing in this particular new space that they have at the Science Museum that engages with his queer heritage, despite the fact there's lots about his early education and his life at Cambridge. So we see in this like the idea that somehow there's an appropriate space for talking about queerness in STEM, and maybe that's in exhibitions that are only about an individual, but that they might not be appropriate in all spaces. For example, this gallery here, which is about information technology. We also talked a lot about one of the things that I was particularly interested in is like trying to expand the concept of what is STEM, which I'll come back to later. A lot of these pictures, these like lighter purple pictures that all look kind of the same. These are all taken in the same gallery in front of, you can see in the background here,
some infographics about early nursing and healthcare, and I'll talk about this in a minute. But the reason there are so many pictures in this gallery is it's the only place in the Science Museum in London that has air conditioning, and it was an absolutely boiling month of July last year. So and we are all in all of these pictures. Just enjoy the fact that we are like very sweaty queer bodies inside this very safe, dry scientific space. So this was a project that was funded by the British Society for the History of Science, and I ran in conjunction with my colleague Damien Arnest-Dilton, who's down here at the bottom as well. But I highlight this because even though some of these people, like Alan Turing, are well-known scientists within the British canon, it's not well-known that they're queer scientists, and a lot of people didn't know about them at all. So I surveyed a lot of the people who came on these tours, and only a third of the people who came on the tours had ever heard of Alan Turing, or any of the other people that we had on this tour, and a third of the people who came had never heard of any of the queer scientists or science that we talked about. And this was a bunch of people who had self-selected to come on a tour about queer heritage in STEM. So they obviously have the interest of learning about this, but they have none of the knowledge about what kind of content might be in this space. So this highlighted to me the fact that like there really is a dearth of understanding like queerness, LGBTQ identity within the physical sciences in particular. So I'm going to depart at this point from what we've heard about on the panel, which is more about like medical history, and think specifically about physical sciences, so things like physics, chemistry, and astronomy. If you'd like to read more about my tours, I wrote this up for the British Society for the History of Science until I think maybe next month. This is online free at the URL that I've put down there, so you can read more and more eloquently about like the work that I did and what that project entailed. So I am starting to use some autoethnographic, like queer autoethnographic methods in my research, so thinking about how I experience being in these spaces along with what is in those spaces to start with. So my research sites are the Science Museum in London, the Natural History Museum in London, and the Royal Observatory at Greenwich. And in all three museums, I look specifically at the galleries that are focused on space science. But I try and think about how does my experience being in those spaces as a queer person, how does that shape and perhaps like re-lens what is there? And I'm going to share with you today a couple of things that have really like highlighted, like I've really been noticing, and they've really come to my attention. And I'm using the fact that they are important to me as a jumping off point. So it's more the fact that they exist and I have noticed them that I find important, using this like autoethnographic idea of like what is speaking to me within those galleries. So I was brought up on a diet of women in STEM narratives. As we may know, women in STEM are very underrepresented. This delightful tweet from UNESCO this year, this was in February, science has no gender. We all need 100% of our brain power to address the global challenges. We need more hashtag women in science. And then I've put alongside this two projects that are unrelated to this tweet, but are also focused on bringing up women in science in the UK. So STEMETS is a program that trains young people, and WISE is the Women in Science and Engineering campaign. But I just wanted to highlight that this is something I'll come back to in my talk. This is also, I hate this picture. I hope that we can all imagine why I might hate this picture. And actually, my friend doctored this image, and I think this is super important because what I hate the most about women in science campaigns is often that it focuses on promoting white, straight, cis women. And that is not inclusive in and of itself. This is not necessarily more inclusive, but we have to be like one of my other friends was like, I hate that they are all wearing pretty shoes. I'm like work in a lab. Never once have I worn open toe shoes like this before in my life. A lot of my friends are computational scientists. They don't wear lab coats or goggles. So when we think about like who we're representing in science and who we're showing and displaying when we're talking about inclusion in science, I think we need to be really critical about the types of images that we are putting forward in those spaces.
But more than that, I want to think about genders in STEM instead of just women in STEM. So this is information that I've taken from a report that I went to a publication of on Wednesday this week, so this is very new. This is information that's come out this year, and it's about how do people experience STEM environments based on their gender. And as you can see, there are lots of all of the groups of people, men feel most comfortable in science spaces, which is perhaps unsurprising, given that it is a space constructed around like the male identity. But what's interesting is that women aren't actually the people who are least comfortable in STEM in general at this moment in time. In particular, non-binary people feel in the UK, this is just a survey of UK individuals, feel more discomfort within those spaces than any other group of people. And transgender individuals experience this more acutely than cisgender individuals. And actually, they had other survey. If I would highly recommend this report if you're interested in knowing about like anything to do with STEM, physical scientists in STEM. They have a lot of information about people wanting to leave, and 50% of transgender individuals who work in scientific professions, so chemistry, physics, and astronomy at the moment, who responded to this survey, 50% of them said that they sometimes or often think about leaving STEM fields because they feel so uncomfortable in those spaces. So I think that's really interesting when we think about like what are we putting in these galleries and museums to include people in science and to make people feel like this is a space that they can come to and that they are included within, and how does that propagate forwards into who is expected to be in those spaces and who is anticipated within the actual scientific fields that people aspire to. I've been doing some work on like who is represented, specifically who is represented within these scientific fields, and I just want to give you a little bit of a highlight about the Exploring Space Gallery at the Science Museum in London. This is a map. Going to draw on the idea of like the godlike view at this moment, but obviously no one experiences the gallery this way. It's just a nice plan view of how this is laid out. I've boxed the different sections of this gallery so you can see, and each part, there are like little stars on this diagram like this. Each of these is a person, a picture, or a model of a person in that gallery space. And what you can see is that it's very grouped by the area. So this area down here at the bottom that's green, this is a history of rocket building and rocketry. So very centered on like the person narrative in this space. But all of these people are men. The blue bit at the top is planetary science, so there's like not very much when we talk about like going to other planets. The orange bit next to that is astronauts, and we'll come back to the astronauts that are there in a minute, but that's the other place that lots of people are visibly represented. This pink bit down at the bottom is about the future of space science, and I'm going to come to talking about the future of space science later in my talk. And then the yellow box is a temporary exhibition that's there at the moment on Skylark, which is an early British rocket. Now, something that's really interesting about this gallery, but I won't spend a lot of time on today, is that like a lot of space science galleries are motivated by national discourses. So quite heavily implied in this is that Britain is the originator of rocketry. So not only is Isaac Newton given a prominent role within this space, because of his work on like the laws of motion, but down here, in the very first figure you encounter as you come into this gallery, because this is the entrance to the museum on the right. Sorry, I'm very dyslexic. On the right. So the first figure that you come across is somebody who was a general in the army in the 1800s, and during a battle in India, they actually stole a bunch of rockets from the people who were there, brought them back to the UK, and then claimed that they had developed these rockets and were like pioneers of rocketry, when in fact they had been used against the British forces in this fight. And that narrative is entirely erased and is subsumed as a British narrative within this space. Cool. So just to come to some women in this gallery, so the blue circles are women, the pink are people of colour, and this one dot that is blue and pink is Mae Jemison, who's an astronaut of colour. But as you can see, though, there's not very many women, and there are no non-binary people in this space at all. In fact, when we think about like norms in these spaces, not only are Mae Jemison down here is not named, I just know that it's her from seeing her picture everywhere, so there's a double erasure of women of color with no names, but there's also some racialized norms drawing on Hall's work in the 1990s, like sexualization of black male bodies. We can see this present in this space. This astronaut here under the washing in space section is the only person who is naked in the gallery. So there's an idea of like reproducing the like racialized and sexualized norms at the time that this gallery may have been produced. There's also some strong gendered norms that are reproduced in this space. There's kind of a dividing line. So the five women who are on the right-hand side are named. This is Helen Sharma's spacesuit, but we can see it's kind of hung in a dead limp way. And there are no pictures of her, and there's no recognition of her work as the first British astronaut. Lisa Ruffer is a technician. The Queen isn't really named. She's named as the Queen, which is kind of her job title. So like, I put her on the named side, but I don't know if that really counts. And Lucy Green, a professor of space science at the University College of London, is in this gallery, but only commenting on the work of her male peers and doesn't discuss her own work at all. We also then see, I put Mae Jemison on this side, these three women who are also included in the gallery who aren't named. I don't know who they are, and I can't work out how to find them. I know it's Mae Jemison because this is a very famous picture of her, but the other two women are technical workers, and this again reiterates things like Simon Shapiro's work about the erasure of technical work and technicians within the STEM fields. So we can see in here like a really interesting case that like not only are we reproducing racialized and gender norms, but we're also like putting down particular groups of working practices within science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So my work that uses a queer lens to think about like what would be better, what could we do to improve this, and one thing I'm going to focus on just now is like how when we think about the future, we construct it in particular ways. So when I think about gendered performances, we're also thinking about like how does that construct sexuality in the future. So in these gendered spaces, in particular in space science, whenever we talk about sex, it's always implicitly about reproduction. So like how do we reproduce in space? You may have seen in 2017 a lot of stuff about NASA sending an all-female crew to Mars, specifically so they wouldn't have sex. And this is interesting as a narrative discourse because, like, firstly, it assumes that like none of these women would want to have sex with each other. But it, more in particular, that the idea of sex is exactly collapsed upon the idea of reproduction. And so often in space science, we see these discourses where anything to do with erotic or sexuality is specifically to do with being reproducing or procreating or like a future. And if we think about like the idea of the child and how this narrative is very focused on like the idea of future children, we can see an interesting problem with like a queer perspective on this, where maybe we shouldn't be focusing always about like the future of the child of the future and how they are going to be brought about in space. So my favorite piece in the Science Museum is this. Obviously, there are no people here, but this lovely little deck chair is about a future on Mars. I think this is really interesting. I've just written an article about this that's coming out, or like a popular article about this that's coming out soon, but I thought I'd read you a little paragraph about this that I've written. So take, for instance, the lone deck chair on Mars in a diorama about the future of space at the Science Museum in London. This chair that sits in the diorama a little higher than the head of the average seven-year-old is the focal point of an imagined space or place. So I'm using Lisa Misery's idea that in order to make space feel like somewhere we can go to, scientists and, in this case, museum curators make these distant worlds into places that we could imagine being in. So to whom might this deck chair belong? In itself, this deck chair typifies a nostalgic past in the UK. The candy stripes would not be out of place in a historic promotional print housed in other museums like the Victoria and Albert Museum across the road for railway trips to the British seaside. So you can see things like this. This narrative discourse of the historic British beach seaside is almost inseparably and imperceptibly intertwined with Western European white nuclear working or middle class families. In Beyond the Bathing Bells in 2004, Haring argues that through the genre's use of the male gaze, these posters construct heteronormative mothers or wives and their children. This reading of the family is encouraged by this diorama. The mother and child are merely missing momentarily in this display, the presence of the children's beach essentials, a bucket, spade, and that parental favorite, sun cream, suggest they will be back shortly. Cool. So I want to use this as an idea of thinking about like who is going to be part of this spacefaring future. What kind of people would feel like this is somewhere that they could be, and what kinds of narratives are we constructing within those spaces? Having seen within this space already that this is a very white, male-dominated environment, there aren't very many representations of women, non-binary, people of color. This isn't only in the space science in the science museum. I just want to like reiterate that my presentation has been mostly focused on this, but this is something we see across the museum studies that I'm looking at. This is a still from a video at the Royal Observatories at Greenwich. The caption underneath this text says, "Let's begin here." Just off to the right, you can see somebody's elbow. This is a white woman who is BSL and interpreting what is a male voice's narrative of this space, but you can see this pictured image here appears constructed as like a default male. There's nothing particularly that marks this person out as anything other than male. And although the white outlines is clearly a stylistic choice for this entire film, the fact that so often and so continually space futures are represented as being white, the fact that this figure is colored in white reiterates that to the viewing public. So that's the end of my presentation. We'll leave it here. I'd hope that these two parts about like the future of space and what is already there would knit together a little bit more nicely than they have. But thank you for bearing with me. And if you have any ideas about how I could more closely link these two parts of my talk, that would be wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ellie, and to all of our speakers for really fantastic presentations. We're now going to open up for questions for about 15-20 minutes. So would anyone like to ask a question? Yes. Do we have one? Sorry.
I'm Sabrina from the University of Augsburg. I have two things. One for the first talk about your question, is this a queer archive or not? I don't have an answer for you, obviously, but this is a question I deal with in my own research. And I feel like looking at what people collect, a lot of the like conversion therapy or aversion therapy seems to be, you know, this obviously within scopes of collection. So some people seem to think it is part of, you know, the narrative, obviously, and should not be overlooked. But I don't know if that makes this easier or not, because it's not probably not a queer thing in and out of itself. So, yeah, I'm also just very interested in the discussion about how this relates to queer lives. But for the last talk, because you're wondering about how to connect the two things. Probably obvious thing is like science fiction and how science fiction plays into these spaces. And I know the Science Museum in London is ramping up a huge sci-fi exhibit as well. So I think because people actually working in STEM and especially things like Star Trek are so closely intertwined, I think this is where this comes in, because they all automatically almost always try to imagine, you know, utopian versions of the future or even dystopian, but just sci-fi through what we have in technology now, or even look into fictional texts to build that stuff that we see on screen. So I think that's like the obvious connection, and both of these worlds are often still white. I mean, sci-fi claims to be very diverse, but often if you look into its core, it's not very queer or diverse, really. So I think that might be your connection, if that helps.
Thank you. I was there a question for me then? I didn't quite understand the question.
No, it wasn't. I'm also trying to grapple with this, so I was wondering if you could also elaborate on how, like, is this a queer space? Like, what are your thoughts at this point? Like, is it a queer archive?
It's a queer archive. I have my thoughts, but maybe I'll come back at the end and give my thoughts on it, because I'd prefer to hear what other people say first before giving my take on it.
On the note of the sci-fi,
some of the representations of people in the gallery are from science fiction things, so particularly in this idea of developing the rocket between 1850, when this the stealing of rocketry technology and then subsuming that into a British imperialist narrative, and when people like Goddard and von Braun start making rockets in the 1930s, 1920s, and there's lots of science fiction. So actually in the gallery they have some stories by Jules Verne. So what's interesting is maybe not all of sci-fi is super white and male and straight, and there are queerer and more inclusive parts of those discourses, but it is interesting that in the gallery space, the ones that they have chosen do also conform to this idea of a very capitalist white space. So I'm looking for the Bridging the Binaries tour. We're doing the Whipple Museum, which is the History of Science Museum, and they have some of the globes that were painted based on the ideas that Mars was had Martians. So this was when people started getting good telescopes, they started looking at Mars, it looked like there were canals. They're actually just land features, but people thought they were canals built by a super capitalist race of utopian future Martians, and they have globes that are painted with these industrialist Martian spaces. So I think that's interesting, and something I might bring in there is the idea of what do we think of the perfect space future, and what were those late 1800 industrialists looking for when they looked at Mars and they were trying to see a utopian future.
Thanks. Thank you. Is it working? Thank you for. Oh, sure. I'm Manon Parry, University of Amsterdam. Really interested in this panel because I'm a former medical museum curator, and now I'm writing a book on the social relevance of medical museums. They do have one, even though they get a lot of things wrong. But I'm motivated then to think about just how valuable the observations you've both made are to the curatorial staff, so I'm interested in how much you discuss the projects and your insights with them, and also how much from those kinds of interactions you can gather about what goes on inside the institution, because there's a huge difference between what a curator wants to do and what the institution allows them to do, or what ends up in the final exhibition. So if you could reflect on that. And then one question for Kate, another really fascinating presentation and the archive. I'm intrigued by whether you are not faced by any legal restrictions on looking at that patient information, and is that just because it's not in a formal institution? And also how you went about tracking down people who you had found, because you kind of exposed their anonymity then when you revealed to them that you found them through the archive. Thank you.
So one thing that Kyle and I hinted in our abstract that I didn't kind of focus on in this version of the presentation was the idea that one of the functions of natural history museums is to naturalize the history of violence that produced them. So kind of when you, especially like a classic natural history museum like the American Museum of Natural History.
The Teddy Bear Patriarchy.
Yeah. It's
an excellent paper.
It's funny because what's amazing about it is that it's now very out of date feeling, because it's been many years since it's been updated. But you do get this kind of procession through time, and then these materials have been gathered here without consequence, just for your edification. And what's amazing about what Decolonize This Place does with their tour is that it's people who come from the communities who are misrepresented in those dioramas. So it's like this literal coming to life, and you can, in those moments, it becomes very clear the kind of violence that's hidden behind each of those dioramas or display cases. And I think for Kyle and I, thinking about Welcome's grant-giving operations, but also in London, its own exhibition practices, there is potentially a similar relationship to the naturalizing of histories of violence and abuse by a pharmaceutical company presenting histories of healthcare, in that their financial success depends on the suffering of people who either received drugs that were inadequately studied, or as a friend of mine had, to be clear, I use the Wellcome Trust Library all the time. It's a fabulous library. I was paid to install this work through money from a grant. I'm implicated in this. But, you know, like, Welcome in the 80s discovered a treatment for the herpes virus, but also discovered that there was no market for a completely benign skin condition. And so they created a marketing campaign to socially stigmatize herpes, right? Like, herpes doesn't do anything to you unless you have a very bad, you know, like, it's not like a crisis. So they produce, you know, like, so if you, that's a very minor version of it, but I think if you understand part of the work of pharmaceutical companies is creating these experiences of exclusion and violence, then to, like, have them exhibit these histories is very similar to me to the kind of function of a kind of enlightened naturalist museum. And I think that's the question that is often forgotten to be asked by curatorial staff.
Talking about my work's relevance to curatorial staff, there's like 2 points. When I started my PhD, and for the first like 20 months of my PhD, I worked at the Science Museum. I was an explainer, so I did like the engagement for young children. And that was also incredibly like white and male and straight. Even introducing things like these tours was quite a big, I was followed around. Even though I worked there at the time I gave these tours, it wasn't part of my work, but I knew all of the security team because I worked there every day. They still followed me around the museum while I was doing this tour, and I could hear them talking on the radios to like make sure that they were like tracking where I was doing this tour as an intervention. So it's relevant to me because it was part of both my like research practice, but also my professional practice in terms of thinking about like how can I make this space more inclusive for in this particular case like queer and LGBTQ identifying people, but more generally like the vast majority of children who come to the Science Museum come from inner city London, and that is a very mixed population in terms of like ethnicity and race and skin color and religion and things like that. And like the museum really does in my opinion, I'm sorry if anyone disagrees, but does a really terrible job of making that space inclusive when there is a huge amount of money, time and effort spent in the United Kingdom making science education in schools more inclusive. So I think this is really important because somehow within the museum space, informal science educators like our team were working hard to try and change their work. And I understand that like it's difficult and expensive, but there didn't seem to be a similar curatorial push in the like curation of the main galleries. In terms of like how does this reflect the stuff that the curators wanted to do, I try not to spend too much time talking to the curators for two reasons. Firstly, the galleries that I look at are actually like assemblage, kind of like bricolage galleries. They're things that like were created a long time ago. So this science museum's gallery was originally started in this particular space in like the late 1980s, and over the time between the 1980s and now, there hasn't been like one singular revamp, but people have installed little bits along the way, and they've changed different parts of it. There is a plan for an overhaul, and that's going to be done with in conjunction with someone from my department, so I'm hoping to get involved in that. But I actually don't think that it's very fair for me to like place this at the doors of the single curators who are responsible for that collection right now, because it's not necessarily their choice what is there, but I think like what I'm trying to draw attention to is like they're spending £2 million revamping the shop, and I always get this like, oh, we don't have enough money to redo this gallery space, and it's like, well, no, like you've just, as we discussed yesterday outside in the small group space, like you have the money, you have the power, you have just decided you wanted to exercise that in a different space, and it was less important to you to change and radically like reform the types of people and the types of narratives that you're constructing in the first gallery in the museum that people come into. It's like the one people have to walk through to go to the toilet. So like everyone goes through that gallery because everyone's been queuing to get in, and it's less important for you to change those narratives in there than it was for you to redo the shop, and I think that like for me that's an important commentary on like how do you actually see this space. I understand that shops generate revenue for museums, and I recognize that there is like underfunding problems and things like that. However, I think that like when we think about what is the purpose of this space, and if the purpose of that space is to encourage young people to join STEM, then like this is something that has to be addressed more urgently. Sorry, I feel like I really went on about that, but it's close to my heart. Also, just to pick up on something you said, I shameless self-plug, I made a podcast called Behind the Glass Cabinet, and what I did was talk to people about how they experience objects within science museums, and one of the people, Zia, used to work at the Wellcome Collection, their podcast is on a representation of like somebody who's had an amputated arm and the space within the museum and how that's constructed. So talking about like the medicalizing and showcasing of these bodies. And there's also another one by Hannah. I'd recommend it. I made it, obviously. But Hannah talks a lot about indigenous knowledge that is lost and not represented within science within natural history museums. So that's also.
I was asked a direct question.
Yeah. To this one, no.
Oh, no. No, sorry. Okay. No, but I was asked a direct question that was separate to that.
Oh, I thought you were going to answer right. Sorry, do you want to answer now?
Oh, no, there was also again. But yeah.
Okay, sorry, I thought you were.
You're good.
Say something now.
Yeah, I do.
Oh, great, good. Yeah. Good. Sorry.
Thank you.
Is it my turn?
Yeah.
Good. On the question of legal restrictions and anonymity, so in terms of legal restrictions, that part of my talk was the bit where there was a misunderstanding about the timing, so I kind of got out of whack. But to explain, to clarify, this wasn't not a process of me going through the archive, finding names and then tracking people down. Very the opposite. So I put out the word, I started spreading the word that I was doing this research. And I was put in touch with people very sensitively. There's some people sitting in the audience. Maybe he's gone. Nick Henderson put me in touch with someone. So people heard that I was doing this research and they said, oh, I know someone who was treated by Neil McConachy. I'll ask them if I can put you in touch. That's the way that it happened. And then seeing their names and meeting these people, I was going through the records and I thought, oh, I wonder if that name matches that person, and then I would check back with them. So that's the way that has been happening, not the other way around. In terms of the archive as a whole, when I arrived in the Blue Mountains at his daughter's place, there were 16 boxes. I'm left with 9. The other boxes were boxes containing... He died in 2005. He retired from the university in 1997, but he continued as a private practice psychiatrist dealing with private patients throughout the last decade of his life. He shifted to issues of pedophilia and sexual abuse, but he was also a consultant expert and a consulting psychiatrist on gender dysphoria. He would make gender dysphoria diagnoses. He was consulted by courts. He was called into court appearances. He was called in various official capacities. So he was the resident expert in Australia for many years on assisting people getting documentation and that kind of thing. Those files, as I started to go through, I would open a box, I would look at the year, and if it was anything past 1979, I put it aside. So I think your question is still something that is a live question in my research for the other files, but I also want to make clear that in my PhD, for example, I'm not actually using the patient files. I'm using the material to get a general overview of his clinical trials, his experimentation process, and his scientific development. I'm not interested so much in... I'm not using these patient files to get patient insights. I'm using published papers, oral histories, and I'm using a methodology of reading the medical literature for direct quotes from patients in the medical literature through the voices of the psychiatrists to try and actually read for patients' experiences in that. So in answer to the questions of ethics and anonymity, my research doesn't out anyone. And all the people who are named in my research have given me their consent to be named in the PhD.
Thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity of speaking. I'm James from the Sydney Pride History Group. So two quick comments and then a question to the panel. In response to your questions, your provocations to us, Kate. So a lot of our members are survivors of Neil McConachy's experiments. There is so much trauma attached to that survival, including Fabian Lascivano is one of our members also. You asked two questions, which I thought were very sensible and provocative questions. One is, what are you going to do with it? And that goes to a theme that I think has been picked up nicely through the conference about, you know, we're here in Berlin at this particular moment, but the lives of archives go on into the future. So this particular archive has trauma all over it. So what you do with it and when you do that with it is significant. So thank you for asking the question and being conscious about possibly, probably, fanning a whole lot of trauma that's there. You also asked, is the archive queer? And I just say, in the same way that is the archive traumatic, it's neither of those things. It's we who impose that queerness onto the archive, or in fact, the line that you're treading is imposing the trauma onto the archive, or extracting trauma from the archive. Of itself, it's just a bunch of nine boxes. So my question to the panel is something that I think you've all three of you done particularly well in your presentations today, which is how you've exposed your archives. You've done very creative presentations with film, with personal writings that are not academic, Ellie, with the photographs and the personal story, the personal connection that you brought to yours, Kate. So I just ask you to maybe all reflect on creativity as a mode for exposing an archive and the importance for all of us in just the way that we all work with our archives to bring something other than just the paper or film or whatever it is in the archive to expose it. What's the importance of creativity to that process?
So I make art, and part of my study of like public history has been to really think critically about the value of empiricism in historical work and its overriding dominance in the field, and how oftentimes empiricism means that these potential kind of queer meanings to archival research can be lost in this effort to prove something and to demonstrate a truth. And so for me, the kind of with this project, it was like, I mean, there's a lot of things to say about Germ City that I didn't get into, a lot of much more problematic things than Jordan's artwork, which isn't a problem, but is a question, really. But I thought, actually, the thing that's much more interesting for me to say is there's this completely fictional movie from 1993, and it somehow, in this, like, kind of, you know, it just has all this kind of visionary qualities to it, and I just, that's why I chose that empiricist song, because it's like, if a science museum or if a naturalist museum or a history museum can't escape basically humming that tomb, then we're kind of fucked. And so that's kind of what I try to do when I work with historical information in my own art practice. And I kind of am very inspired by John Grayson's work to kind of to that end.
Just quickly from me on creativity, also just on the question of empiricism, so obviously that's something that comes into Neil McConachie's work, and it's kind of this, how do we understand empiricism? You're talking about positivist empiricism. I think for McConachie, he would have argued that he was a humanist empiricist. So, I mean, there are differences of interpretation there as well. But in terms of creativity and Fabian Loschiavo, so Fabian Loschiavo is not shy about talking about this stuff. He went on national radio in a podcast with me earlier this year. He's very, very open about having been treated by McConachie, but he also makes very, very clear that he doesn't think McConachie was an evil person. And I'm happy to give people the link for that podcast. It's in a fascinating episode. I recommend that. But for Fabian, a lot of his trauma, and it wasn't just trauma from the therapy, actually. It was trauma from a whole lot of other stuff as well. Homophobia, for example, just general kind of social homophobia. He became a performance artist, you know, and he expressed a lot of his trauma through becoming one of the, I think he's the mother inferior of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence in Australia. And he's been this amazing creative presence in the Australian gay movement and gay scene, which I think is a beautiful way to be able to say, well, this is what happened to one of these patients. You know, the story of his treatment is a very little blip in his kind of life experience, but he's managed to kind of work it through in being in creative ways. Just a little comment on that.
I think that it's like the idea of like exposing these things creatively is really important. I think often when we think about constructing, especially science museum exhibits, the powers of empiricism really do like override the way that we think about these things. Like I often hear people when I'm doing my like field work talking about like objectivity in the museum and like, well, this is just how science is. So even if it's not how people are constructing these spaces, it is how they are reading them. And so I think that like the creative types of things that I try and do are to try and highlight like the creative choices that are being made in producing these spaces in the first place. So yes, I run a tour that only highlights like queer scientists, but like I could run a tour that only highlights women, and they're like I could run a tour that only highlights like people who grew up in Yorkshire, and that's a creative selection that I'm making in the same way that what is in the gallery is a creative selection that somebody else made. And so I think that like one of the things that is important is when we think about these creative choices, like these are choices that people have made, and so by trying to like draw attention to the choices that have been made through like maybe more queer practices or highlighting more queer things. I'm trying to say like we can make these queer choices. We could make these like you know, feminist choices. We could make choices that celebrate and highlight the contributions of people of color, of people of different nationalities. We could make choices about like how do we deal with colonialist and imperialist violence within these spaces, but we don't. And so something I'm trying to do is like say like if we tried these creative things, perhaps there's a way in of understanding the types of choices we are making and seeing them as creative choices as well. So I think that's where I'm trying to go with this. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And thanks to our three fantastic speakers and for you for coming to this panel. And now we have our lunch break. Thank you.